So there I am, on a hot Saturday in July, going to Barnes & Noble to see if they can track down somewhere a copy of Arnold Schoenberg's letters. And there, amazingly, on the shelf, is the book. Not exactly light summer reading. Schoenberg, you may remember, is the composer who was said by some to have destroyed music by abandoning tonality in the early 20th century. By going, in a very short time, from this to this, just a few years later. He turned classical music on its ear. So why the letters? Because my interest has been piqued by an unlikely confluence of Schoenberg events, recordings, concerts, and most of all, Alan Shawn's recent book, Schoenberg's Journey. Schoenberg is, of all things, in the air.
Well, isn't it amazing that such an interesting personality somehow isn't a part of people's general consciousness the way other fascinating figures from his time are?
Alan Shawn's book has a photo of the composer on the cover, and he's looking very human, gazing quizzically into the camera, which is a departure from the formal, stern photos of Schoenberg one often sees.
I fought very hard to have it not be that and have it be the really terrific picture that is on the front of him holding his hat in his hands and standing on a ship where, you know, he really looks like he's on a kind of magical and strange voyage that surprises even him.
Schoenberg's strange voyage took him from the 19th century into the 20th, from Vienna to Hollywood, and from an explosion of success to almost total alienation from the music community. And now, back again, perhaps, he emerges from Shawn's book as a complicated, sympathetic man possessed by genius, compelled to bring music into what was then the future, having begun in the most logical way, as a composer immersed in classical tradition.
He was steeped in the three B's, basically, and one M, Mozart. He adored Mozart.
He had taken the music world by storm with Verklärte Nacht, Transfigured Night, and Gürlieder, a gigantic two-hour song cycle.
When he was young, he had a tremendous success and notoriety, which won him all the praise from Strauss and various other important musicians of the day.
Fred Sherry has just recorded the Schoenberg Mon Cello Concerto.
As soon as he diverged from that path, somewhere around Opus 11, everybody gave up on him, and he's really submerged and never came up again in his entire life except among a few dedicated musicians.
And yet he, as they say, went there.
The question about what happened to Schoenberg and why he did what he did is something that everybody would answer, all musicians would answer in a different way, but once that door was open, he could never really turn back from it.
It was a step being taken in the arts in general in this period, as World War I was on the horizon. It was unique in history.
To go from painting in which you can recognize right off the bat what the objects were that were in front of the painter to paintings in which you're looking at forms and compositions without any clear reference, that's an unbelievable step.
And the parallel in music is starting out knowing you're in one key or another.
To go from that to music in which you are not in a key at any point and you do not resolve into a key at the end, that is simply an astonishing thing.
Even our hero, Arnold Schoenberg, and his circle were astonished.
Webern uses the word panic about that moment in their work when they realized that it no longer actually was true to the piece to pretend that it had been tonal. To simply display a tonal coat of arms, to use Schoenberg's phrase, at the end of a piece when it hasn't been tonal at any other point felt dishonest and ridiculous.
So he went all the way.
You might say he relaxed. He faced the implications of the language that, in fact, he was using. Those sounds were valued in a new way for their own sake. And in the Book of the Hanging Gardens, I think Schoenberg found that there was an incredible beauty and magic to letting that language of tones be what it really wanted to be. There are songs in there that are like Gershwin if he was, you know, maybe stoned or something. They're so beautiful, they just don't happen to resolve. You want to sing along, and every single song is just so fantastic.
Singing along with Schoenberg may be the province of a special few. He didn't make it easy. But knowing more about the man helps, and Sean's book reveals maybe a kinder, gentler Schoenberg.
Well, I mean, gentle is not exactly the word we would use, is it? But kind, definitely. I mean, he tried tremendously hard to help colleagues and friends who were trapped in Nazi Germany when he himself had gotten out. He himself was impoverished, but he taught Berg for free because he believed in Berg's talent.
Even when he was borrowing rent money from Gustav Mahler.
I did talk to his son, Larry, once, and he said that his father was, in fact, a very sweet man, and that when Arnold Schoenberg would pack lunch for his kids to go to school, that he would cut out the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in the shape of eighth notes.
What a guy. So what about the letters? The one I keep coming back to is the one written on the 12th of May, 1947, from California to Hans Rosbaud. "There is nothing I long for more intensely," Schoenberg writes, "than to be taken for a better sort of Tchaikovsky. Or if anything more," he continues, "than that people should know my tunes and whistle them." I don't know if I'm ready to whistle his tunes, but 51 years after his death, I'm ready to listen again to what Schoenberg did and try to hear it anew. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishkin.